Welcome to Living the Good Life. This is Teresa, and we're having our friends again go over some of our earlier episodes and talk about some of the basics for things you might have to change if you have suffered from a disability later in life. It's not always easy. We do have suggestions. There are some free documents for download that can help you. There is also a book that we've written. We do have a free download for a very, very short part of the book. Also, you can buy the Living the Good Life, a 70-day workbook for living well when your body changes. And you can, like I said, you can check that out, but take a listen.
Imagine waking up, walking into your kitchen, and opening the silverware drawer, only to realize that the handful of random spoons sitting inside are literally the only currency you have to survive the rest of the day.
Right. Yeah, it's a completely different reality.
Exactly. Every single thing you do, you know, showering, making coffee, answering a quick email, it's going to cost you one of those spoons.
Right.
And when they're gone, I mean, you are just done. So if you're prepping for a meeting, or maybe you're just incredibly curious about how humans adapt, this deep dive is for you. We're looking at a stack of transcripts today from a project called Living the Good Life.
Yeah, and it's this massive, really fascinating synthesis of discussions. It serves as this incredible overview of how people actually rebuild their lives after major physical or energetic shifts.
This is just so relevant for anyone dealing with, well, having a human body.
Totally. We're decoding the behavioral psychology, the neurobiology, and, you know, the really gritty logistical realities of living with chronic illnesses, disabilities, or even just natural age-related changes.
And because aging comes for all of us.
Exactly. It's basically a masterclass in how to construct a life that feels positive, realistic, and highly intentional without all the info overload.
And by the end of this deep dive, you will seriously never look at a drawer full of silverware or the word should the same way ever again.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah.
The sources make this bold claim right out of the gate, which is that before we can even talk about changing our physical habits, you know, our daily routines or energy management adaptation has to start with our vocabulary.
Yeah, the language we use to process our reality, it basically dictates what we can physically do.
It does. And it starts specifically with the words we use in our own heads. The sources lean really heavily on Dr. Shad Helmstetter's research on self-talk.
Right. The brain as a literal processor.
Exactly. He points at something foundational to neurobiology. The brain is a literal processor. It literally does not distinguish between a casual wish and a direct command. It just follows the strongest programming you feed it.
It's basically an obedient machine.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have a sense of irony or nuance when it comes to your internal dialogue.
Precisely. And that brings us to the immense biological danger of the word should. Helmstetter classifies should as level 2 self-talk.
Level 2, okay.
Yeah, it's a level of recognition, but it's deeply tied to disbelief, pressure, and guilt. When you tell yourself, like, I should get more exercise, but I'm tired, your brain hears that should and instantly triggers a subtle threat response.
Because should feels like a nagging external boss standing over your shoulder with a clipboard.
Yes, that's exactly it.
It just makes you feel inadequate, which immediately makes you want to rebel and, I don't know, sit on the couch instead.
And that external pressure creates a measurable physiological reaction. Should activates the amygdala, which is, you know, the brain as fear center. It induces mild stress and guilt.
Wow, just from one word.
Just from that one word. And when the brain feels threatened or pressured, it goes into a defensive posture. It justifies why you aren't doing the thing. It actually inhibits the prefrontal cortex,
which is the part responsible for problem solving.
Yeah, exactly. Problem solving and forward action. It literally shuts that down.
Which is why the sources heavily contrast should with the word could. They classify could as level 3 self-talk.
Right, level 3.
So if should is the demanding boss, could is more like an internal explorer handing you a map. It moves the brain away from obligation and toward choice. But, I mean, let me push back a little here.
Yeah.
Is it really as simple as swapping one single word? Does the brain actually rewire just because you said could instead of should?
It sounds too easy, right? But the underlying mechanism is actually profound. Could lowers that threat response we just talked about. It shifts the brain into a state of possibility, curiosity, and most importantly, safety.
And a safe brain is ready to learn.
Exactly. A brain that feels safe is primed for neuroplasticity. the ability to form new neural connections. But we have to be incredibly careful here because the sources identify two very different types of could.
Wait, the grief could versus the agency could.
Yes. The grief could operates entirely in the past tense. It is saying something like, I could run faster 10 years ago, or I could navigate this airport without help before I got sick.
It anchors you in loss.
Completely. You are programming your literal processor with a continuous loop of mourning, which reinforces a state of helplessness.
So the antidote to that is the agency could.
Exactly. The agency could operates strictly in the present or future tense. I could take a 10-minute walk today, or, you know, I could try a modified, seated version of this task.
That activates self-efficacy. It tells your brain that you have capability right now in the exact body you currently have, not the one you used to have.
Right. And there's also this concept mentioned in the sources called the pink elephant rule.
Oh, I love this one. The visual cortex struggles with the word not.
Yes. If you tell yourself, I shouldn't be nervous about this doctor's appointment, your brain skips right over the shouldn't and zeroes in on the word nervous. It visualizes the anxiety.
It's like telling someone, whatever you do, do not think of a pink elephant.
And boom, there's the pink elephant. Your visual cortex conjures the exact image you supply. But if you shift that to an agency could and say, I could be calm, you feed the brain a positive target to move toward.
It's one thing to change your vocabulary to I could, though. I mean, that positive self-talk kind of falls apart if you're constantly haunted by the exact precise memories of what your healthy body used to be able to do.
Yeah, that's a huge roadblock for a lot of people.
Right. So to actually adapt, we have to look at how the brain fundamentally alters the way it stores memories as we age or as we go through these major life shifts.
Which takes us into this fascinating concept called fuzzy trace theory, or FTT.
FTT, yeah.
It's a dual process model of memory that explains how we actually extract meaning from our lives. So we store two types of memories for any event. First, we have verbatim traces,
which are the exact objective details.
Right, the precise facts of what happened. Second, we have gist traces. Mm-hmm. These represent the bottom line meaning, the emotional truth, or like the core lesson of the event.
And the research here shows something that completely upends how we normally view cognitive aging. As we get older, our brains naturally move away from retaining those sharp verbatim details and lean way more heavily into gist reasoning.
Which the sources emphasize is not necessarily cognitive decline. It is an upgrade to wisdom.
Okay, wait. I have to push back a bit on that. Isn't losing exact details genuinely a bad thing? It sounds a little bit like we're just trying to put a cheerful, positive spin on memory loss to make people feel better about it.
I totally get that, and it is a completely valid fear. Losing those sharp details is genuinely a form of grief, and we really shouldn't minimize the frustration of, you know, forgetting a specific name or a date.
It's scary.
It is. But from a purely neurological survival standpoint, the brain is trading that verbatim data for something far more useful. Accumulating verbatim details takes up immense metabolic energy.
Oh, so it's a resources thing.
Exactly. As we gain experience, the brain filters out the noise to extract the core lesson. People change their behavior when the meaning of an event shifts, not when they memorize a list of facts. Gist is what actually drives human decision making.
The sources give a really clear medical example of this. So imagine a doctor tells a patient they have exactly a 22.2% risk of a surgical complication.
Right, so that 22.2% is the verbatim trace.
But no human being makes a life-altering medical decision based on visualizing the number 22.2. They extract the gist of that data, like that risk feels too high, I need to protect my body, or that risk is negligible, let's do the surgery.
We act on the gist always. And when we apply this to body disruptions, letting go of the verbatim details of your old healthy body is the only way to accept the gist of what you can still do.
Like the example with Parkinson's in the text. The verbatim detail is the physical tremor. It's the mechanical difficulty of the movement. But the gist is their deep intention to move, to connect, to be part of the room. Or for someone experiencing memory loss, the verbatim is forgetting the specific details of a past vacation. But the gist is the enduring joy and the emotional bond they share with the person sitting right next to them.
I love that. You stop worrying about the verbatim shoulds of your physical limitations and you start living in the gist coulds of your human spirit.
It's a beautiful foundation. But, I mean, eventually you have to execute these intentions in the real physical world. And what happens when your body simply hits a wall? A positive just mindset cannot manufacture cellular energy out of thin air.
No, it definitely can't. And that brings us to the cold, hard economics of chronic illness.
Which brings us right back to that silverware drawer we started with. The origin story of spoon theory is just famous in the chronic illness community.
Oh, yeah, it's a legendary.
It started in a diner in 2003. A woman named Christine Miserandino was trying to explain to her healthy friend what it physically cost to live with lupus. Words just weren't working. So she grabbed 12 spoons from the tables around them, handed them to her friend, and said, "This is your energy for the day."
Right. Those spoons represented her daily biological budget. And the profound realization of spoon theory is that healthy people wake up with an abundant, almost limitless reserve of energy.
They don't even calculate the cost of existing.
Exactly. But for someone with a systemic body disruption, every single action has a tangible, non-refundable cost.
The breakdown in the sources is staggering when you actually look at the mechanics. If you are healthy, waking up and taking a shower costs zero spoons. You don't even think about it.
Nope, not at all.
But if you have lupus, waking up with severe joint inflammation costs 2 spoons before your feet even hit the floor. And if you have MECFS, which is myalgic encephalomyelitis, or chronic fatigue syndrome, waking up unrefreshed might cost 4 spoons.
And then taking a hot shower could cost 3 more because the heat causes blood to pool in your lower extremities, which leads to this intense dizziness.
So by the time the commute to work is over, the healthy person might have spent, what, 0 to 3 spoons?
Yeah, at most. While the person with lupus has spent 7, and the person with MECFS has spent 18 spoons before they even reach lunchtime.
That's incredible. They're operating in severe biological debt before the day has really even begun.
And we aren't just talking about a person being tired. That's a huge misconception. We are talking about literal cellular failure. With MECFS, the mitochondria in the cells are failing to convert ATP, the molecular currency of cellular energy, into usable fuel.
Wow. The sources also mention POTS, right? Postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome.
Yes, POTS is a perfect example. This is where your autonomic nervous system misfires so badly that just standing up to brush your teeth causes your heart rate to spike to 150 beats per minute.
So your body is running a marathon while you are literally just standing at the bathroom sink.
Exactly.
So having a chronic illness is basically like living on a prepaid debit card with a randomized, wildly fluctuating balance every single morning while everyone else around you is walking around with a limitless credit card.
That is a perfect analogy. And to manage that randomized debit card, you have to use a clinical tool called activity aggregation scoring.
Activity aggregation scoring. It sounds complicated.
It just means evaluating the true comprehensive spoon price of a task. It's not just the physical cost of like walking or lifting. You have to calculate the cognitive cost of focusing on a screen, the sensory cost of navigating bright fluorescent lights, and, you know, the emotional cost of interacting with people.
That is just an exhausting amount of mental math just to exist.
It really is, which is why occupational therapists rely on the 4 P's to help people survive this economy.
Okay, the 4 P's. Pacing, planning, prioritizing, and positioning.
Right. And positioning is a prime example of changing the physical mechanics of a task to save a spoon.
Oh.
It can be as simple as just sitting on a tall stool while you chop vegetables at the counter.
Because by sitting, your heart doesn't have to work as hard against gravity to pump blood.
Exactly. Which preserves your energy for something more meaningful later in the day.
It's the same with managing the cognitive load of a disability. Like if someone experiences vision loss, their brain is suddenly working twice as hard neurologically just to keep them balanced and to navigate a familiar room.
Every little thing costs extra.
Right. But, you know, when your daily spoon count is consistently that low, despite all the pacing and planning, you eventually have no choice but to rely on external support. I mean, running out of spoons just means you need help.
Yes. And bringing someone into your fragile energy economy requires extreme care. The dynamic between a care receiver and a caregiver is incredibly delicate.
It can fall apart so easily if the fit is wrong.
Totally. The sources outline some major red flags that indicate this partnership is going to fail.
Like what?
Well, for caregivers, red flags include operating with a savior complex, or becoming easily frustrated when tasks take longer than expected, or routinely ignoring the care receiver's stated spoon limits.
Oh, that's a big one.
Yeah, or frankly, just lacking the physical strength to safely help with heavy transfers from a bed to a chair.
But there are red flags for the care receivers to watch for in their own behavior too, right?
Oh, absolutely. Things like expecting your caregiver to be available 24/7 without their own rest. or stubbornly refusing to use adaptive tools like a shower chair that would make the caregiver's job significantly easier.
Or operating with the expectation that the caregiver can just magically read your mind.
Exactly. Which is where spoon theory comes back in as this vital neutral language to bridge the gap. Saying, "I am out of spoons," removes the moral weight from the situation.
It establishes a hard biological boundary rather than sounding like a personal failure or some passive-aggressive excuse to get out of an activity.
Right, it depersonalizes it.
But practically speaking, how do you actually avoid the silent resentment that inevitably seems to build up when one person relies so heavily on another for their basic daily needs?
It's tough, but the sources emphasize proactive, structured communication. Before committing to a long-term caregiving dynamic, you do a trial run.
Like a weekend stress test.
Exactly. Treat a weekend as a stress test to evaluate the physical and emotional compatibility. Use clear I statements. But the most effective protocol they suggest is explicitly checking both people's spoon levels before discussing anything logistical or emotional.
Oh, that makes so much sense. If the caregiver has zero spoons left after a long shift, and the receiver has zero spoons because of a symptom flare, trying to discuss finances or scheduling is guaranteed to end in a massive argument.
Guaranteed. You have to acknowledge the biological debt first and delay the conversation until the bank accounts are replenished.
So taking all of this out of theory and turning it into a real sustainable life obviously requires a blueprint. We have the new language of could, the gist reasoning for memory, the spoon counting, the caregiving boundaries. The sources provide a framework for integrating all this called the 70-day change plan.
Yes, and they suggest using travel as the ultimate stress test for this new lifestyle.
Travel is definitely a stress test, but why 70 days?
The timeline of 70 days is rooted in hard neurological data. Dr. Philip Alali's behavioral research demonstrates that it takes an average of 66 days for a new complex behavior to become automatic.
Okay, so roughly 2 months.
Right. And furthermore, a recent 2025 study from McGill University showed that 10 weeks, which is 70 days of consistent cognitive practice, actually rejuvenates the brain's cholinergic system in older adults.
Wait, how does that actually work mechanically? I mean, does the thinking positive thoughts just magically heal the brain?
Not magically, mechanically. The cholinergic system is the neural network responsible for flexibility, learning, and readiness to change. The plan revolves around a daily noticing practice.
It's not just forcing toxic positivity.
No, not at all. You ask yourself five simple questions every day, such as, what did I notice in my body today? What felt easier by just 1%? What surprised me?
Okay, small things.
Exactly. By forcing your brain to scan for novel positive stimuli, you are giving that cholinergic system a daily workout. This practice literally thickens the neural pathways associated with adaptation. You stimulate acetylcholine production.
Wow.
Yeah, and over 70 days, this repetition moves you from level 3 self-talk, I could, into level 4 self-talk, which is identity-driven, I am.
Oh, I see. So you evolve from saying, I could be patient with my fatigue, to I am someone who honors my body's current pace.
Precisely. And when you apply this recalibrated identity to travel, you realize you need a highly practical approach. Because travel is a chaotic environment practically designed to steal your spoons.
It really is. So the sources recommend something called the buffer protocol. The first rule is physiological. Never book a 5 a.m. flight.
Never.
Because waking up at 2 a.m. completely disrupts your circadian rhythm, it spikes your cortisol levels, and it bankrupts your baseline energy before you even reach the airport doors.
You're starting in the negative. And the second rule is logistical. Swallow your pride and use TSA cares or the airport wheelchairs.
I mean, the psychological resistance to accepting a wheelchair at an airport is massive. For a lot of people, it feels like giving up or publicly signaling a loss of independence.
And that right there is the verbatim memory of a healthy body haunting the present reality. But the occupational therapy math is undeniable. Walking 500 yards on a hard airport concourse while pulling a heavy bag costs 4 spoons. Riding in a wheelchair costs 0.
So it's not giving up. It is a highly strategic move to protect your investment in the trip.
Exactly. You save those 4 spoons so you actually have the cellular energy to enjoy a meal when you land at your destination.
You shift travel from being a gamble with your health into a controlled environment where you manage your spoons rather than letting the environment steal them.
Which is also the logic behind the one major event rule.
Right. A healthy tourist itinerary is like a museum at 9 a.m., a walking tour at noon, and a dinner show at night.
Which is a spoon nightmare. A spoon-managed itinerary allows for just one anchor event per day. You do the midday museum, perhaps using a rented mobility scooter, followed by a mandatory horizontal rest period in a dark, climate-controlled hotel room.
Just to drop your heart rate and let your autonomic nervous system reset.
Exactly. You are intentionally building environmental redundancies. You're designing a vacation. And really, by extension, a life around the concrete reality of your biology rather than the memory of your past capabilities.
Adaptation really is a quiet, continuous recalibration, isn't it?
It really is. It requires shifting from the pressure of should to the possibility of could. It requires focusing on the core meaning of your experiences. The gist, rather than mourning the exact verbatim details of the past.
Then respecting your biological bank account. Which brings up this massive, thought-provoking shift in perspective regarding how we view human vitality as a whole. We are so conditioned by modern society to view health as the absolute absence of illness.
Right, like if you're not perfectly able-bodied, you aren't healthy.
Exactly. We think of vitality as the total absence of physical limitation. But what if the way modern society measures health entirely misses the point?
Oh, I love this question. What if true vitality is actually the mastery of your specific energy economy? What if your current physical limitations are not a wall blocking your path, but they are the exact architectural blueprint you need to design your most intentional, authentic life?
When you have a limitless credit card of energy, it is incredibly easy to waste your days on things that lack actual meaning. But when you only have 12 smoons, you become fiercely, beautifully intentional about where every single one goes.
That limitation forces profound clarity.
It really does. So tomorrow morning, when you open that drawer to grab a spoon for your coffee, take a second to look at that silverware a little differently. Notice where you're choosing to spend your biological currency today. Catch yourself using the word should and see what happens when you replace it with could. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Respect your baseline, and we will catch you next time.
A quick but important note. The information shared in this podcast is for general educational and entertainment purposes only. We love sharing our insights, but please remember, this content does not constitute medical, health, or professional advice. Everybody and every situation is unique. You should always consult with a qualified medical specialist or healthcare professional before starting any new program, making lifestyle changes, or acting on any information you hear today. Your health is your responsibility, so let's keep it safe.